Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, the President of Iceland, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, speaks on the role of the North in global business and politics. As the first person in Iceland to hold a PhD in political science, Mr. Grímsson became the first professor of political science at the University of Iceland in 1973. Representing Reykjavik, Iceland's capital city, Mr. Grímsson was a member of Althing, the Icelandic parliament, from 1978 to 1983 as part of the People's Alliance Party. In 1987, he was leader of the People's Alliance Party, where he served as the Minister of Finance from 1988 to 1991. Mr. Grímsson was chairman and later international president of the International Association of Parliamentarians for Global Action from 1984 to 1990, and he has sat on the board ever since. An association of over 1,800 parliamentarians in about 80 countries, the Parliamentarians for Global Action organized the Six Nations Peace Initiative, for which Mr. Grímsson sat on the executive committee. On behalf of the association, Mr. Grímsson accepted the Indira Gandhi Peace Prize in 1987. Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson was first elected as President of the Republic of Iceland in June of 1996, and this past August he was re-elected for his fourth term as President. Mr. Grímsson addressed the Alaska World Affairs Council for the second year in a row on September 25, 2008, speaking on the role of the North in global business and politics. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents the President of Iceland, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be back in Alaska and to be able to speak to you again. I think I was here last October and addressed you. I don't threaten that it will be an annual event, but I have half jokingly, because there's a lot of talk about Alaska, as we all know, emphasizing after I came here a few days ago, that in recent years, I am the president who has been most often to Alaska. And that includes President Bush in that category. And none of my colleagues in the world have been as often to Alaska as I have in recent years. And they have missed a lot. They have missed a lot. And when I came here for the first time, the position of the North and the Arctic on the global scene was such that it was necessary to devote a major time of our message to emphasize why the Arctic and the North should be a crucial concern in global discussions and decision-making. Now we no longer have to spread that message, because now the world has moved in such a way that the North and the Arctic has become the centerpiece of the evolution of the world in coming years and decades. And I know it's a strong statement, but I believe fundamentally that it is true. And I will tell you why. There are three major concerns or challenges which the world, mankind, has to deal with in coming years and decades. One is climate change, the melting of the ice in my country, in Greenland, in the Arctic, and in Antarctica, which threaten to raise the sea level of countries all over the world. I was in Bangladesh a few weeks ago addressing a conference of Southeast Asian countries on rising sea levels and climate change. And it's absolutely clear to the country of Bangladesh that the greatest security threat it faces in the 21st century does not come from the military in the neighboring states, Pakistan or India or the others. The greatest security threat that Bangladesh faces comes from the melting of the ice in our part of the world, which threatens to eliminate a large part of the landmass of Bangladesh and make millions and millions of people completely homeless. And similarly, island states all over the globe, especially small island states, face the prospect of their landmass, their entire territory, disappearing completely. We sometimes talk about climate refugees, but these people would not be refugees in the classical sense, because that term means people who can and want to return to their former home. These will be exiles because their home will have disappeared completely. Similarly, cities in the United States, New York in Florida, London in Europe, everywhere in the world, we face a monumental challenge of climate change. We can argue, how has it been caused? Is it partly created by the activity of mankind, or is it partly a result of natural cycles? In any case, it is happening. And it's happening three times faster in the northern part of the world than anywhere else. So our territories, the North and the Arctic, has become the most crucial theater of the global climate change debate. And what's happening in our neighborhoods, to our people, to our states, and to our nations, will be closely monitored and examined by the entire global community. Greenland has not been up to now a very popular destination. But now, there's a large crowd of global leaders who take pride in declaring they've been to Greenland. We sometimes talk about to be a witness to the creation, and we read in the opening of the Bible how the Almighty created the earth. Now global leaders are eager to be witness to the threat of destruction caused by climate change, by the melting of the ice. And if the entire Greenland ice sheet disappears, it will raise sea levels worldwide by 7 meters. 7 meters. And what is happening in Greenland and the Arctic this year and last year is what scientists expected to happen in 50 years' time. And the American Space Agency, which is perhaps the primary scientific institute in the world, has come to the conclusion that the disappearance of the ice and the breaking of the ice sheet in Greenland and the Arctic last year is on the scale that few years ago the scientific community was convinced would only happen in 50 years' time. So the North and the Arctic is already serving as the testing ground and as the central theater for the global discussions and deliberations and dialogue concerning the greatest threat and challenge of the 21st century, because the damage that would be caused by irreversible climate change, it will be greater than the results of World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression combined. It's almost impossible for us to realize what is at stake. So, this is the first reason why the North and the Arctic has now become the crucial theater. In a similar sense, perhaps, as the Middle East has been a crucial theater of conflicts and energy questions in the last few decades. And that brings me to the second reason why the Arctic and the North will have a crucial role in global politics and the global economy in the years to come, and that is the energy provision. The Arctic and the North harbors about a quarter of the unused energy reserves of the world. About a quarter of what we as mankind can hopefully achieve in supporting the activities of our economies are the energy reserves that range from Russia across the north into Canada and Alaska. And we only have to reflect for a minute about the role of the Middle East in recent decades and the importance of oil to realize what is at stake. And some of the countries in the Middle East which have become prominent and wealthy global players because of their oil reserves have already realized that their reserves will soon run out. Abu Dhabi, which is one of the richest countries in the world, providing enormous amount of money into American banks and financial institutions in recent years, having one of the strongest so-called sovereign funds in the world, has already discovered that their oil reserves will run out in 60 years' time. That's less than I have lived so far. And when the world looks around for where is it possible to tap the new and additional energy resources, the Arctic and the North will be top of the agenda. So we face the formidable task, how do we organize that? How do we decide the scale, the priorities, the nature of the exploitation and the use of the energy reserves without threatening the development of climate change at the same time? I have sometimes said that to some extent, climate change is not the right term. Because what this is all about is the future of energy. And there is no question as crucial to the world economy in coming decades than the energy question. And there, again, the countries and the regions in the North are in a core position. The third reason why the Arctic and the North has moved up on the global scale in the way I've indicated in my opening remarks here today, is the melting of the ice is already opening up shipping routes which have been closed for centuries due to the frost on the ice, but are now being opened up at a greater pace than anybody could have expected. And these new shipping routes will link Asia to America and Europe in a completely new way and have a revolutionary effect on global trade and shipping and commerce, even greater than the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal combined it in their times. And if we look at how China is gradually, whether we like it or not, becoming the major powerhouse in the global economy, perhaps in the same way as the U.S. obtained that role following the Second World War. These new shipping routes between China and other countries in Asia and the United States and North America and Europe will be the main commercial shipping lines of the 21st century. But it is also an enormous task of how will they be organized. Geographically, as we all know, Russia is the major landmass that lines these sea routes. And of course, without making agreements and treaties and formulating regulations in cooperation with Russia, it will be very difficult to utilize these new opportunities. And that brings me to the fourth reason which is Russia, with all its resources of minerals and energy and timber and others. Russia, whether people like it or not, is going to be a major player in the 21st century economy. But Russia is also, which I don't have to tell you here in Alaska, the predominant northern country. And it will not be possible for the rest of us in the global community to deal successfully with these challenges and create a basis for our prosperity and welfare in the future unless we integrate Russia in a constructive way into this system. And there I believe the northern approach has better and stronger and more positive opportunities than the traditional conflicts between the continental countries in Europe and Russia. And therefore, we who are in the north, like Alaska and Canada and the five Nordic countries, should institute a new approach to Russia in this way, which would have positive implications for many other global issues in the years and the decades to come. All of these reasons, which I have here briefly outlined, would be sufficient to make the Arctic and the North into a priority area for global politics and business development in the 21st century. And I would even go so far as to say, without successful solution to the problems in these areas I've here outlined, and without the people and the institutions in the North playing an active role, including the state of Alaska and us in Iceland, the rest of the world will not be able to enjoy the opportunities for progress and peaceful coexistence as they would do if we successfully solved this. But there is also yet another area, somewhat different from these, which makes the North and the Arctic an interesting testing ground for new legal agreements and international law. Because the Arctic and the North is probably the only part of the world which is still a kind of new territory with respect to international agreements and treaties. Of course, we have the law of the sea, but because of the Cold War and in addition the frost and the ice, which has kept people isolated up in the north for centuries, there has not until now been a burning need to create legal framework and treaties between the countries and the nations in the north in order to regulate a solution to these problems. And in the formulation of these treaties and regulations, the northern institutions, in a democratic way, and the people who live in the north must take the leadership if we want the formulation of these agreements and treaties to be based on a democratic will. And there, in a fascinating way, we will face the challenge of how do we bring together the traditional rights of the people who have lived for thousands of years in the North and in the Arctic, and the claims of the states which have existed in this part of the world for a relatively short time. I know the United States has been in existence, like Canada, for about two centuries. My own republic was established 60 years ago. The present Russian state is not yet 20 years old. But the people who live in the north, whether they are in the Russia or Alaska or in Canada or in the Nordic countries, they have been here for thousands of years. And they have, as you know, their own language, their own traditions, their own customs, their own view, their own vision, and their own claims. And there are people all over the world, in Africa, in Asia, in Central America, Latin America, and elsewhere, who are closely watching how this dilemma will be sold up here in the north. Because the earth is crowded with tribes and small communities and others who have lived in the lands for thousands of years before the colonial powers from Europe started dividing the world up between them and then decided to leave. And we only have to look at the map of Africa to see how the colonial power, in a haphazard way, using a ruler, decided that the boundaries should be straight lines. So also, from the democratic point of view, and on the fundamental issue of the rule of law and human rights, the classical essence of the Western democratic tradition, what makes us special in world history as well as in our own minds, this will be a crucial test for us. How we solve this democratic dilemma of creating new laws and treaties that will harmonize the traditional right of the people and the individuals who have been here for thousands of years and the interest of the existing state structures in our region. And if we take all of this together, it is, in my opinion, a fascinating privilege as well as an inspiring challenge to be a citizen of the North at these particular times. Because never before have the people of the Arctic and the North been given the opportunity to provide leadership on a global scale as we are now being provided. But it's fundamentally up to us whether we want to take that chance and whether we want to exercise the right and the power that comes with it. And part of my mission in recent years, and one of the reasons why I'm still coming back to Alaska, is to emphasize the need for a new, constructive, broad, and dynamic cooperation in the North. Because I believe that constructive solution to these challenges is not only important for us, but absolutely essential for the rest of the world. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the President of Iceland, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, recorded September 25th, 2008 at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska. Following his talk on the role of the North in global business and politics, he responded to questions from the audience. First, in reference to the sovereignty challenges the North will face as it becomes more open, an audience member asked, does Antarctic cooperation provide any sort of model for this dilemma?
Well, the short answer to that is no. Because the fundamental distinction between Antarctica and the Arctic is that the Arctic has been for thousands of years the venue of human drama and societies and tribes and customs and movement and so on. As you all know, 1,000 years ago, my ancestors came across the ocean and discovered America. Then decided not to tell anybody about it. And went back to Greenland and then consequently to Iceland. But it is an evidence that 1,000 years ago, people were moving in the north in a fascinating way. And they still are. I have visited both Chukotka and Yamal Nemets in Russia. And as you know, being neighbors of Chukotka, there are reindeer herders on the tundra who have lived there for thousands of years and still have no fixed home, but move around according to the needs of their reindeer herd. For them, the new state of Russia is just like a small spot you get on a radar screen for a second. Because not only have they seen the Kaiser come and go and the communist regime come and go, I mean, they have seen so many regimes come and go that they have absolutely lost count. But Antarctica has been the playing ground of the powerful countries who have had the scientific strength and the navies and the financial resources to make a claim. And they are still negotiating how they should do it and how they should run it and so on. So I think, of course, what we do in the Arctic, we have to bear in mind how it will reflect on Antarctica. But I think the main traffic, if I can use that in terms of models and so on, will be from the Arctic to Antarctica rather than the reverse. The Antarctic is more a question of negotiation between the states rather than the democratic dilemma and the challenge which I outlined for the Arctic and the North.
Next, an audience member asked President Grimson to discuss Iceland's economy and the economic challenges Iceland has faced in the last decade.
You said that in the last decade or so, Iceland had faced serious economic challenges. That's not entirely accurate, because the last decade or so has been an enormously successful period in our history, with high rates of growth, with Icelandic companies becoming major players, both in the European market and in the global market, in areas where we had no presence before, like banking and finance and telecommunications and pharmaceuticals and many others. And the history of Iceland in the last 10 years is really how you can create strong and successful global companies from nowhere or from anywhere, from small and isolated communities, that the playing fields in the global economy have now been leveled in such a way that anybody can have the ambition to succeed. We have, however, in the last year or so, faced some problems, part of them created by ourselves, like inflationary pressures that were due, on the one hand, because we decided to go into an enormously big power construction in the eastern part of Iceland to provide electricity for a new aluminium smelter built by Alcoa, which was the biggest and the newest Alcoa aluminium smelter. And this, of course, created some strong inflationary pressures because of the investment and the activity. And at the same time, there was a boom in the housing market, but also enormous profits that came from these global Icelandic companies, especially the banks and our financial funds. And that has created a situation which is a bit unstable, especially with respect to the krona. And this has led all kind of geniuses in other banks and financial institutions, as well as in the international financial media, to write a kind of alarming report about Iceland. I'm sure you've read some of them. Part of this is because Iceland lends itself to interesting headlines, like Iceland is melting or Iceland on fire and this kind of thing. And sometimes when I read this report, whether it is in well-known world-class financial papers, I wonder if the rest of the report is as accurate as it is what they're writing about Iceland. And if that is the case, I'm not sure whether I will continue reading these papers. And then we have had various banks and financial institutions, the so-called evaluation departments of these banks, issuing reports. You have this crowd of people in these international banks and financial institutions doing all kinds of reports about companies and countries and so on. And banks like Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and the others, in the last 12 or 18 months, were issuing all kinds of reports that the Icelandic banking community and financial institutions were collapsing and would go bankrupt and disappear in the immediate future. Well, we all know what happened to Lehman Brothers. We all know what happened to Merrill Lynch. But the Icelandic banks are still going strong. That's an interesting moral in that as well, that I hope in the future some of our friends in the international banking community will be less arrogant in their judgment about others and perhaps be more concerned about their own backyard than issuing reports on some faraway countries. So if you ask me the question, should you put your money into an Icelandic bank or a bank on Wall Street? I would say today, putting it into an Icelandic bank would be a better bet. But of course we have difficulties. Every economy has difficulties and fluctuations and so on. I think our biggest challenge, both from an academic as well as economic point of view, is really this question, because we have our own currency, is whether a small and highly successful economy with a wide global range can maintain its own currency in a long period or not. And there are some who argue, yes, it's possible. There are others who say it's doubtful whether it's possible. But that has more to do with the financial market and the success of our economy rather than fundamental problems. If we look towards the future, Iceland, like Alaska, is well-placed because we have enormous energy resources. And I believe that there is now already a race on in the global economy for long-term access to energy resources. And those regions and countries and states which can provide that access on a long-term basis are extremely well-placed in terms of their financial and economic health if they play their cards right in the coming years and decades. We also have, like you here in Alaska, enormous water resources. We are, in fact, the largest reservoir in Europe left of clean water, the drinking water. And that is becoming an extraordinarily valuable commodity. We are even negotiating now with Saudi Arabia to sell them regularly water transported by tankers from Iceland to Saudi Arabia. We also have, like you, large wildernesses of nature, nature in its pure form. And the hundreds and hundreds of millions of affluent people in Asia and all over the world are eager to experience nature in the open way, the wilderness, which both Iceland and Alaska can provide. So if we only take these three fundamentals, energy production, availability of water, and open wildernesses, with respect to the global tourist economy, both Alaska and Iceland are much better placed than most of the rest of the world. And if we cannot make a success of that, we only have to blame ourselves, quite frankly. So I am optimistic, while I recognize there are some problems.
As an international spokesperson for alternative energy, with Iceland being one of the highest producers of alternative energy in the world, are you encouraged that other countries are beginning to adopt alternative energy plans? An audience member asked.
Well, I'm very much encouraged because I see a fundamental shift in that area in the last few years. It has increasingly become a part of my mission to engage in such discussions with leaders in China, in India, in Africa, in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. We are now building, for example, geothermal urban heating systems in China, enabling the Chinese citizens to close down their coal fire stations and use clean water to heat their houses instead. We are engaged with the small African country of Djibouti of completely transforming their economy from oil over to geothermal production, making Djibouti, hopefully, the first clean energy African country. We came here to Alaska last year with a delegation from our energy companies and our banks, advocating that Alaska should create a comprehensive plan to utilize your geothermal resources. And we described a model based on the Icelandic experience where you could first use the water at high temperature to produce electricity. And after the water had done that, you would take the same water into the city of Anchorage and build an urban heating system. So you would replace your existing resource of energy for the heating and replace it with geothermal water. And once this water had heated your house, it's still the same water. It would come out of the houses like it does in Iceland and melt the snow and the ice on your pavements and on your driveways. So the Icelandic geothermal model is a multi-business model, where in addition to the energy production, you can use it for heating houses, you can use it for greenhouses, spas, tourist locations, and so on. And as I said to some of your official yesterday, in the terms of the modern tourist industry, there is nothing as extraordinary to sit in a geothermal pool and watch the northern lights and the stars in the deep frost of winter. And I can assure you there are millions of people in Asia eager to experience that. I must say I find it a bit crazy that people are willing to travel half the world just to see the northern lights. But it is a fact. And if you can add a hot geothermal pool, you are even more attractive. Our problem now in Iceland is that we have so many requests for partnership from China, India, Indonesia, Philippines, the Middle East, Central America, Europe, and so on, and we can't deal with it all. That we need partners from other countries. And in fact, we already have reached the stage where the lack of drilling companies is a stumbling block, because the speed has been so fast in this race for access to clean energy that the drilling companies have not kept up with it. Because the international corporate world has more or less concluded that those companies that can obtain a long-term access to clean energy will be much better placed in global competition for two reasons. One is that their customers and their clients increasingly want to know that the product has been created in a responsible way. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, they have all concluded that sooner or later there will be a carbon tax in whatever form. And those companies which have established a long-term access to clean energy will have to pay less and will be in a stronger position. So therefore, states and regions like Alaska, which can provide enormous amount of clean energy, is, like my own country, are in enviable position. And I am happy to say that some of the rules and the regulations that characterized the bidding for the geothermal resources here in Alaska a few weeks ago were formulated in the light of our discussions that we had here last year. And in my discussion with the Lieutenant Governor yesterday, I welcomed a delegation from Alaska to Iceland in the coming months to take a closer look at our model and see how Alaska could adopt it.
Next, an audience member asked, how is the fishing industry faring in Iceland as the economy flourishes and develops?
Well, you're absolutely correct. For the most part of the 20th century, until 10 or 15 years ago, the fishing industry was the backbone of the Icelandic economy. It's doing very well. But proportionally, it is not providing as much to the success of Iceland as it was before. That's not because it has somehow slowed down. It's simply because other things have been added to the Icelandic economy. We introduced a quota system about 20 years ago or so, which has turned out to be very successful in the sense that it has enabled the companies to be profitable. But it has also enabled us to maintain the fish stocks. So we have had a much more successful record of maintaining our fish stocks than most of the other European countries. And this combination of maintaining the fish stocks and using the quota system to make the companies profitable has ensured that despite fluctuations in the Icelandic economy, the fishing sector is still strong. And as you might know, the demand for ocean-grown fish is growing very strongly. And there's one fundamental reason for it. It is that fish farmed in artificial environments somehow does not develop the same essential chemicals like omega-3 and the others which are necessary for our health and well-being as wild fish in the ocean does. Because somehow the movement of the fish in the ocean and the waves and the rocks and so on formulates these chemicals. And the cultivated fish doesn't. And therefore, if the decrease in ocean-based stocks will continue worldwide, it will become a major health problem globally, because a number of diseases will have an easier way to spread, and we will have more difficulty fighting them because we lack these chemicals. And therefore, the economic profitability of ocean-based fishing is, in my opinion, a safe bet with respect to the future, because so many of the affluent and growing middle classes in the world are familiar with this medical knowledge. And like they eat a lot of vegetables and take vitamins and so on, they want to eat ocean-based wild fish. That's also one of the reasons, in addition to everything else, why Alaska and Iceland face a great future.
As the North opens up and opportunities arise to develop new treaties and laws for the current states and indigenous people, as the president mentioned in his speech, an audience member asked the president to comment on the potential for whaling to be addressed as a global issue in the future.
Well, I think history has taught us in the last 20 years or so that to deal with the whaling issue on a global scale is a difficult political endeavor. There is, however, a fundamental difference between Icelandic and Alaskan whaling, or even whaling in Greenland. For us in Iceland, it's not a part of an indigenous lifestyle. It is fundamentally one company which has run our whaling industry and owns the boats and sells the products and so on. So it's very difficult for us in Iceland to argue that it's essentially part of a cultural lifestyles of communities. It is fundamentally commercial whaling. And if it was going to be in operation, we would have to sell the products to Japan or restaurants in the rest of the world. Doesn't matter how much we ourselves like eating whale meat, which, by the way, I do. I was brought up on and so on. I also owned a cat which ate whale meat every day, but that's a different story. So we couldn't really argue that the Icelandic and the Alaskan interest in the whaling go hand in hand. We would soon be found out if we tried to argue that. But of course you will find a great sympathy among the Icelanders for the right of people both in Alaska and Greenland and elsewhere to continue the tradition that had existed for a long time.
The last audience member chosen to address the president asked him to talk about the original factors that led to Iceland's focus on global energy challenges, followed by energy independence and efforts to educate the rest of the world on the benefits of alternative energy.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because when I was your age or so, over 80% of Icelandic energy requirements came from oil and coal. And I was brought up in a fishing community in the western fjords of Iceland, where oil and coal were the only energy resources. And it was part of my daily duty to carry the coal and check the oil for my grandmother to make sure we had heat in the house and could cook the food. And we have changed that situation within a lifetime of one generation. So now, as you know, 100% of our electricity is from clean energy resources, and over 75% of our total energy need, including cars and shipping, comes from clean energy. And now we are gradually going to the next stage where we want to eliminate oil completely from our economy by having electric cars and different fuel for the shipping and so on. And last week I drove the new Mitsubishi electric car, which was exhibited for the first time in the world outside of Japan in Iceland. And we hope that in the coming years we can become perhaps the first completely oil-independent country in the world. How has it been done? Well, it has primarily been driven by local initiatives. It was not been a grand governmental plan in the 60s and the 70s and in the 80s. When the oil crisis that was caused by the Middle East conflict in the 70s increased the price of oil more than 30 years ago, many local councillors in Iceland decided it was kind of silly to pay a lot of currency to import oil to heat the houses if there was geothermal power available. So gradually towns and local communities all over Iceland started drilling for hot water. And then 20 years ago or so, we realized we could also produce electricity from that resource. And then the big power companies, including the National Power Company, which is owned by the state, came into that picture, so far as the electric production is concerned. And now we have a coordinated front between the state, the municipalities, the banks, the energy companies, the business sectors, the scientific community, to make Iceland a predominant clean energy player all over the world. And we are, for example, engaged now with the United States. It is what's called the Iceland Deep Drilling Project, which is based on going as far down as 5 kilometers into the ground and examine how to harness a temperature of 400 to 600 degrees. We all know, because we learn it at school at a young age, that there is a huge fireball inside the earth. And we are walking and sleeping and living and working on a very thin layer on top of that fireball. It's a question of technology, how we can get the heat, which will be inside the earth for thousands, perhaps millions of years to come. And we are getting there. And another aspect which I have increasingly been advocated is that the ocean bottom, the seabed, also has enormous geothermal resources. And giving the technologies of the oil and the gas industry to harness oil and gas from the seabed, in recent years we could also apply that technology to geothermal clean energy from the ocean bed. So there are enormous possibilities in the coming years in order to radically change our energy profile. And Alaska is, like Iceland, blessed with considerable geothermal potential. And with progress in the drilling technology and the engineering methods, Alaska will be even better place to utilize that opportunity in the years to come.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, the President of Iceland. He responded to questions from the audience following his speech entitled The Role of the North in Global Business and Politics. Recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on September 25th, 2008. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.